All right, we are going to Psalm number 34. Continuing our Bible study here, so summary for Psalm 34. Psalm 34 praises the Lord who redeems the soul of his servants. We'll go over that again. Psalm 34 praises the Lord who redeems the soul of his servants. Outline for the psalm, two parts, verses 1 to 7, opening praise and personal testimony. Verses 8 to 22, instructions in fearing God. I'll go over that again. Verses 1 to 7, opening praise and personal testimony. Verse 8 to 22, instructions in fearing God. All right, we'll move on to our observations for Psalm 34. Psalm 34 was written by David. The superscription ascribes it to him. A psalm of David when he changed his behavior before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. So this is the fifth psalm with a historical occasion mentioned in the heading. This occasion refers to the time in 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 10 to 15. David was fleeing from Saul and he went to Gath. And he was there, he was afraid of Achish the king, and he pretended to be insane so that they drove him away. There are various ideas about this name Abimelech here and the king Achish in 1 Samuel. And most likely this name was some sort of a title. Maybe like that of a pharaoh, like the title pharaoh that was given to kings. The name Abimelech literally means "my father is king," and that seems probably the most likely for the use of that term here. There's no musical direction given in this heading or in the text of the psalm. To categorize Psalm 34, Psalm 34 is a Torah wisdom psalm, or a wisdom instruction psalm. The wisdom and instruction elements are very prominent in this psalm, particularly in verses 8 to 14. You have a group of verses in, verse 8 down to verse number 10, which are structured in that proverbial two-line wisdom saying format. And you have a call to instruction in verse 11, which is very similar to Proverbs 3:21, as well as chapter 4, verse 1. The instruction in this psalm is aimed at instilling the fear of the Lord, which is obviously a wisdom aim. This is also described as the aim of the law in Deuteronomy, places like Deuteronomy 4:10 and 6:2 and 31:12 and 13. It was also one of the purposes of the feasts, Deuteronomy 14:23, and it was also the purpose of the kings copying out the law and reading in the law that was to instill the fear of the Lord. That's Deuteronomy 17:19. So this is obviously again a wisdom element. There are warnings against false speech in verse number 13, and that's actually very common in the Proverbs. And when you go through Proverbs and you realize how many sayings there apply to our speech, the use of the tongue, the use of the lips, that sort of thing, they're quite numerous in the book of Proverbs. Also, we have in this psalm, like in verse 14, we have the two ways, which is a wisdom theme. And verses 15 to 22, the end part of this psalm, gives us a good contrast between the righteous and the wicked, not only in their ways, but also in their ends or their fates. This psalm also has some minor elements of a praise psalm. It begins in verses 1 to 7 with a call to praise and gives reasons for praise. And in verse 3, we also see a call for communal praise, a call for the congregation to praise. Now, Psalm 34 is most closely connected to Psalm 25. Both of these psalms have an alphabet acrostic structure. So they have 22 verses relating to the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. They began with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet in the Hebrew text. But they also share a number of repeated terms or themes. For instance, the fear of the Lord, which is mentioned in verses 7, 9, and 11 here and in Psalm 25, 12. The Lord as a refuge in verse 8 here as well as in Psalm 25, 20. The Lord is good in verse 8 as well as in Psalm 25, verses 7 and 8. The Lord's deliverance, which is repeated in verses 4, 17, and 19, as well as in Psalm 25, 20. We have mention of the humble here in verse 2, as well as in Psalm 25, verse 9. The eyes of the Lord, particularly as the eyes of the Lord being on the righteous, verse 15 here, Psalm 25, verse 15. And the Lord redeeming in verse 22 here, and also in verse 22 of Psalm 25. So that is the strongest connections. It's also connected to Psalm 1. Being a wisdom psalm, we would expect there to be some sort of a connection to Psalm 1 that begins the psalms. So we have wisdom instruction, the righteous and the wicked. And again, this is common in Psalm 1. All right, so the poetic features of Psalm 34. Well, we mentioned already the structure, the 22 verses, alphabet, acrostic. And there are various reasons for that. One of those being to aid in memory, the use of acrostics and other types of mnemonic devices that are common to use for memory. So one would be to aid in memory. But another, as we've talked about in the probably in the very beginning maybe of this study, we were talking about Hebrew poetry in particular and how that it works. It's not really rhyme and meter in Hebrew poetry, but it's more in structure, those sort of structural elements, the use of imagery and poetic expressions and all that sort of thing. So that is it's a feature of poetry. It shows the intention and the deliberate nature of the composition of the psalm. So in other words, it shows that a psalm like this it's not the work of just an outburst of passion, so to speak. And sometimes psalms can seem that way. But there is an underlying structure and there's poetic expression that's given. And so it's not just sort of a stream of consciousness outburst of passion. There's not really a lot of imagery that's used in this particular psalm. It makes more use of poetic features such as repetition, poetic generalizations. So we have places in the psalm that refer to no or to none or to all or to every and that sort of thing. Repetition of terms like fear and deliverance and some other terms that are used. All right, so let's walk through the verses of this psalm. 22 verses. We'll go ahead and read this. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make her boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear thereof and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he heard me, and delivered me from all my fears. They looked unto him and were lightened, and their faces were not ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him, and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him, and delivereth them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in Him. Oh, fear the Lord, ye His saints, for there is no want to them that fear Him. The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they that seek the Lord shall not want any good thing. Come, ye children, hearken unto me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is he that desireth life and loveth many days, that he may see good? Keep thy tongue from evil, and thy lips from speaking guile. Depart from evil, and do good. Seek peace, and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears are open unto their cry. The face of the Lord is against them that do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. The righteous cry, and the Lord heareth and delivereth them out of all their troubles. The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart, and saveth such as be of a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all. He keepeth all his bones, not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and they that hate the righteous shall be desolate. The Lord redeemeth the soul of his servants, and none of them that trust in him shall be desolate. All right, so the psalm opens in verses 1 to 3 with a call to praise. David says that he will bless the Lord. To bless the Lord is to worship Him, to praise Him, particularly in thanksgiving. We've seen that in several of the psalms before, Psalm 16, 18, 26, 31. David here vows to continually praise the Lord, and the inference is that this vow is the result of experience of deliverance. And to boast in the Lord, to boast, the word literally means to shine. And it is used to speak of praising. And the humble that are mentioned here are poor, needy, meek, afflicted. All these various terms sometimes are used to translate this word. So it indicates someone that is in some way oppressed, someone that is in a position of weakness or vulnerability, and someone that most likely is being harassed or oppressed by someone in a higher position of power than they are, and they're helpless to do anything about it. And the implication here is that they, such that are humbled, they are gladdened by hearing David's boast in the Lord because of his deliverance. In other words, basically what David does in this psalm is that he uses his personal experience to apply this generally to all those who trust in the Lord. So David has been delivered, and those that trust in the Lord will be delivered as well. He issues a call here to magnify the Lord or to make great his name making his name known. And the implication again is praise. In reference to the Lord's name in particular, obviously, is a reference that it can be to his position, to his or his reputation. Together, or the call to praise the Lord together, is a call for the communal praise. So this is a chorus of the redeemed praising the Lord. Then we get to verses 4 to 7, where David gives his testimony of deliverance. And these verses, you'll see an alternating pattern. Where you'll have a statement of personal experience that is then followed by a generalization. So David has experienced this personally, and he generalizes to say that this is true for all those who trust the Lord. So in verse 4, David was heard. He was delivered from all of his fears. And the word for fear here is actually a different word than that's used of fear of the Lord elsewhere in the psalm. It's a word that points more to just a terror and a fright. It doesn't have the idea of a reverence or a reverential fear like the fear of the Lord. This alternates with application to others. So verse 5 then would be the one that applies outward to others, those who have looked to Him, those who have looked to the Lord. It says that they were brightened or they were lightened, and they were not made ashamed. So their hope and their confidence was not disappointed. They weren't left or forsaken. We come back to David's experience in verse 6, referring to himself as a poor man. Again, poor, needy, afflicted. It points to one in a depressed circumstance, one that's powerless to help himself. And the cry indicates a cry out that's crying out of distress. But the good news is that he was heard and he was saved or delivered from all of his troubles. And so then we go back to the generalized statement in verse 17. The angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. Now this is actually the first mention of the angel of Yahweh, which is what the term is there. This is the first mention in the Psalms. And it is only mentioned one other time in the Psalms, and that's actually in the next Psalm, Psalm 35, verses 5 to 6. The angel of Yahweh, which is a very interesting study that we're not take time to do the whole study of it, but the angel of Yahweh is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. And there are several ways that that is evident as you look at those appearances in the Old Testament. Some of those being the receiving of worship, the angel of Yahweh calling himself God, referring to himself as God, various things like that. But if you take a look at those times that the angel of Yahweh has appeared or the messenger of Yahweh, you will see that usually his appearance is at a time of some special significance in redemptive history. So he appeared on the earth, and again, pre-incarnation. He appeared on the earth at times, particularly when it seemed that God's covenant was in danger of failing, of not being fulfilled. And so he appears in these special times, and he essentially performs a role of preserving God's covenant and delivering his people such that redemptive history continues to flow as God has purposed and promised. So this is a reference to the angel of the Lord. And the word for encamp just means to make a camp, to pitch a tent, actually, I think, literally. And it was a word used very commonly in the Pentateuch, especially in descriptions of the wilderness wanderings of the people of Israel. And so it refers to his near presence to protect and to defend his people. Verses 8 to 10 then give a generalized hope of God's deliverance for all of his people. And these verses are the ones we talked about that take the form of Proverbs, particularly the two-line wisdom sayings. Beginning there with verse 8, taste and see. And that's somewhat figurative language, but what it means is to discern by experience. You might say prove and try, something along that line. And that the Lord is good is in the fullest and the best sense of that word. The word for trust here also in verse 8 means to take refuge. And so the same word is used in Psalm 2 in verse number 12, and so it makes a very similar statement. And his condition is said to be blessed. It's the blessed condition, the happy condition, the prospered condition of those in who have taken refuge or have entered into Yahweh's covenant. Saints, the word for saints in verse 9 means consecrated or holy ones. We have seen it used a few times, and it generally describes those who fear the Lord, those who are in covenant with him, those who have trusted in him. Want is just a need or something that is lacking. And then we have a verse which probably expresses maybe some of the most imagery type metaphor in verse number 10, and that's young lions may lack. In other words, they may know hunger. It's a means of comparison. You know, they may know hunger, but those who fear and seek the Lord will not. Just speaking of his provision and care over those that trust in him. We come to verses 11 to 14, and this is where we get the real heart of the wisdom instruction. It begins with this call to receive instruction, which is much like that in the Proverbs, you know, hear my son, or hearken to what I say to you, something along that line. And even expressly says, I will teach you the fear of the Lord. If you come and you hearken, you come and you hear, you listen, I will teach you the fear of the Lord, he says. And the fear of the Lord is obviously the aim of wisdom teaching. We're told in places like Proverbs 1:7 that the fear of the Lord is the very beginning of wisdom. It's the very foundation of wisdom, and the foundation of acquiring wisdom is the fear of the Lord. One of the things that that tells us is that wisdom is not acquired in pride. Wisdom is not acquired in arrogancy. Wisdom can only be acquired in humility. And that really is part of what the fear of the Lord relates to. It relates to humility. We have an invitation to wisdom, verse 12, which is very similar to a lot of wisdom sayings we see in the book of Proverbs, asking essentially, who wants to see good? Who wants to see long days in life? And these are actually some of the blessings promised by the acquiring of wisdom in like Psalm 3:2, Psalm 3:22, Psalm 4:10, Psalm 9, or I'm sorry, this is Proverbs, not Psalms. Proverbs 3:2 and 22, Proverbs 4:10, Proverbs 9:11, and so on. And then we have a warning in verse 13 about false speech, excuse me, which again is very common in the Proverbs, warnings about speech. But this also would sort of coincide with a theme of false witness that we have seen in earlier in the Psalms. And then we have verse 14 finishing up, which gives us the two ways, which is a common theme in the book of Proverbs, that there's the way of folly and there is the way of wisdom. There's the way of life and the way of death. There's the way of righteousness and there's the way of wicked and so on. So here we have the way of evil and the way of good and peace. And so those two ways are shown and obviously contrasted. Verses 15 to 21 then gives us a list which continues in that wisdom vein and gives us distinctions between the righteous and the wicked. And if you pay attention as you go through these particular verses, you will notice that these distinctions between the righteous and the wicked apply to both their lives on the earth as well as their destinies after this life. So the eyes and the ears here, the eyes of the Lord and his ears in verse 15 refers to Yahweh's knowledge and attention to his people. And it also indicates that there's a readiness to hear the cries. Face of the Lord, obviously face can indicate favor, and it often does, but it can also indicate the opposite, and that's what it does here, because his face is against. His face is not shining upon, his face is not turned toward in favor, but his face is against them that do evil. Not only is his face against them, but it's for the purpose of cutting off remembrance of them from the earth. Now, this is something, this cutting off of remembrance or blotting out of their names is something that we have encountered before Psalm 5 verses 9 and 10, as well as Psalm 9 verse 5. And it is a reference to final judgments. This is a reference to the final fate of the wicked, that the Lord's face is set against them. He knows, he sees, he observes all of their acts, and they're going to be held against them, and ultimately they're going to be cut off from the earth. In other words, they will have no inheritance in the kingdom of the Lord to come. We also see a statement here, verse 17, which is very similar to verse 6, but it's obviously generalized. Verse 6 was David's personal experience, and verse 17 is a general statement about the righteous and how it's a cry to the Lord, and that the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. Verse 18, the Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart, and saveth such as be of a contrite spirit. He is near, being near to, which is an indication of help and the ability to help and the willingness to help and the rendering of help. You remember the cry in Psalm 22 and verse number 11 that it was only troubles that were near and not the Lord, as Psalm 22, obviously having that abandonment theme. But that's not present here, but rather the Lord is near. Now, to be contrite refers actually literally to being crushed. So being brokenhearted and crushed in spirit is the description that is given here of those that the Lord is near and the Lord, His salvation or His deliverance is near. We're also told by verse 19 that the righteous suffer many afflictions, but deliverance means that afflictions will not prevail in separating them from the Lord. So being righteous doesn't mean not suffering afflictions. But what it does mean is that those afflictions will not prevail in separating you from the Lord, that you will be delivered from those afflictions, and that means, in terms of destiny. Verse 20 speaks of preservation, keepeth all his bones, not one of them is broken, which is obviously put for the keeping of the person, you know, that they will not be destroyed. This verse is also alluded to in John chapter 19 and verse 36 about Jesus Christ and his crucifixion, that not one of his bones was broken. And then we have this, verse 21, this contrast then with the wicked. Evil or afflictions shall slay the wicked. In other words, so the righteous shall be delivered from their afflictions, but the afflictions of the evil will be their undoing. In other words, those things that they suffer are a signal of their end or their fate. The word for desolate here means to be punished for being guilty. It's not translated desolate very often. It is in a few more instances besides here. In fact, in the next verse it is, but it's not very often is it translated that way. To be punished for being guilty, or we might say condemned, condemnation. So the righteous will be condemned and their afflictions, or I'm sorry, not the righteous, the evil will be condemned and their afflictions in this life are just merely a foretaste and just merely a foreshadowing of what is to come. And so this is another reference to their judgment. And so that contrasts them again with the righteous. The righteous are delivered from their afflictions. Their afflictions do not signal their condemnation. The psalm ends on verse 22 with an expression of confidence, statement of confidence. The Lord redeems or ransoms or saves the lives of His servants, and none of those that trust in Him will be desolate. So in other words, those that take refuge in Him will not suffer the fate of the wicked. Though they may suffer many afflictions, they won't suffer the fate of the wicked. All right, that brings us to our interpretation. So what does Psalm 34 teach? We have talked at different times as we've been going through these Psalms about the righteous and the way that the Psalms talk about the righteous and who they are. And we've seen many times that it obviously does not mean those that have reached a sinless perfection in this life. And here we also see that it is not those who have reached this higher plane of life where all they know is prosperity. Because Psalm 34 gives us a very detailed portrait of the righteous in this life. So first of all, it tells us of the righteous in various ways that they suffer in this life. So thinking about some of those ways, well, they're described as being the humble in verse number 2. Again, poor, needy, afflicted, oppressed in some way, helpless, might be another way to say it. They have fears, according to verse 4. They have frights, and they have things that are terrifying. They're poor, and they're crying out, and they have troubles in verse 6. They cry out again in verses 15 and 17. Again, they have troubles, verse 17. They are brokenhearted and crushed in spirit, according to verse number 18. And in verse 19, suffer many afflictions. So the portrait of the righteous is that this life is a life of suffering, of afflictions. It's a life of heartache. It's a life of difficulty. Then we also have this portrait of the righteous in what the Lord does for them. So the Lord makes them glad in verse number 2. The Lord hears and delivers in verse 4. The Lord brightens their countenance and makes them not ashamed in verse 5. The Lord hears and saves in verse 6. The Lord delivers in verse 7. The Lord provides so that they do not want in verse 9 or 10, or that their want does not destroy them. The Lord sees and hears in verse number 15. Hears and delivers in verse 17. The Lord is near to them in verse 18. Again delivers in verse 19. The Lord keeps in verse 20. And the Lord redeems and delivers from condemnation in verse 22. So we see a lot of promises and a lot of the activity of God in the lives of the righteous that mingles with their present life and the life to come. The psalm also gives us a portrait of the righteous, though, in their moral life. We certainly don't want to act as if, because the righteous are not described as those that are perfectly sinless, that they're also just perfectly wretched, or that there is no uprightness to their life. And so we look at verses like verses 13 and 14, and we see that they walk in the good way. And those are things related to this life, keeping the tongue from evil, the lips from speaking guile, departing from evil and doing that is good, and seeking peace, and such. So these are very real descriptions of the righteous as they are walking in that way of wisdom in this life. But also in general, as we look at the whole psalm, we see that, that obviously those that are righteous in this life, they're fearing the Lord and they're trusting Him. So the picture we get from the righteous in Psalm 34 is that they do suffer in this life, and that suffering is no indication of being forsaken by God. On the contrary wise, the wicked and those that do evil, the sufferings and afflictions that they undergo, they are indications of being forsaken by God, and that will ultimately undo them in their condemnation. Now, Peter referred to this psalm, and particularly he quoted verses 12 to 16 in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 to 12. And in the context, Peter is speaking about suffering, the suffering of the righteous, or suffering for righteousness' sake. And he's also in that context speaking about not taking personal vengeance, but leaving that to God. In other words, putting your trust in God, meaning that leaving that vengeance to God, trusting in God in the face of enemies. So obviously that would be another characteristic of the righteous that we would see, not avenging themselves, not seeking to try to mete out God's justice on others, but rather trusting in the Lord and committing themselves to Him for His keeping. Well, that brings us to the messianic hope in this psalm. Verse number 20, as we mentioned earlier, is alluded to in John 19:36 as being fulfilled in the fact that none of Jesus' bones were broken in the crucifixion. And this identified Jesus as the Passover Lamb of God that was sacrificed for His people. Exodus 12:46. Gives the details. The bones of the lamb, of the Passover lamb, was not to be broken. In John chapter 1, he introduces and announces Jesus Christ as the Lamb of God. Paul obviously as well saying that He is our Passover who was sacrificed for us. So this was literally fulfilled in the death of Jesus Christ, that not one of His bones was broken. And so in His death, He's actually delivered. And in fact, the word for redeemed that is used in the second part of the verse that Jesus quoted from the cross in Psalm 31, verse number 5. He committed his spirit into the hands of Yahweh, and that word for redemption that is used here in Psalm 35 is used there in Psalm 31 and indicates that the committing of his spirit to Yahweh meant the redemption of his life. So then, reading this psalm as a messianic psalm, as it obviously is since it was fulfilled in Jesus Christ on the cross. So David, who was God's anointed, was rejected and afflicted. That's why he was fleeing from Saul and why he ended up in Gath. But David did not avenge himself, but trusted in the Lord and experienced deliverance that meant the deliverance of all God's people. And that's obvious in David's Psalms. So then, likewise, Christ entered into our afflictions and bore our sorrows and our shame. And his deliverance is the deliverance of all who trust in him. All right, so we'll go to application. I have three of these. Number one, understanding Psalm 34 helps us today to understand that joy in life is a gift from God and not something that is achieved. So all of the terms that are used to describe the righteous as we went through this psalm, all of those terms are, generally speaking, terms of neediness, terms of helplessness, terms of dependence on others, and in this case, on God. So David is clear that deliverance wasn't due to him. It was due to the Lord. Number two, understanding Psalm 34 helps us today understand the pursuit of God and his good gifts over earthly honor and earthly stuff. And we see that coming through in the psalm repeatedly, that David was seeking the Lord. He was seeking after him. We read in this psalm about God's nearness, about his open eyes and his hearing ears, even though we are brokenhearted. And so from this psalm, we would see that that's a greater treasure that surpasses the gold of earthly kings. Number three, understanding Psalm 34 helps us understand today that yes, we will suffer afflictions, and many of those may well be at the hands of evildoers, but that suffering doesn't mean our undoing if we trust in God, if we are taking refuge in Him. And we don't need to try to avenge ourselves, but to trust in the Lord. All right. Any questions on Psalm 34? Yes, I do believe it does. Well, the his then would refer to the righteous, or, you know, those that are delivered. He keeps all his bones.
So the Lord keeps all the righteous bones.
Right. Yeah. But ultimately fulfilled in the Lord keeping the bones of the Lord, you know, in his crucifixion.